Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Every week, we take on an important issue. We are not defined by ideology, politics, ethnicity, religion, but rather the truth. That's what we seek. And as you will see, we're going to do that today. There are questions abounding today, including, did the Lancet engage in a disinformation campaign, or was it used by Dr. Peter Daszak to promote a particular ideology, a way of stopping people from examining where the coronavirus may have originated? We're going to look at many issues today, but the broader, larger issues are what's important. The overarching theme is the illusion of evidence-based medicine. And joining us today, via California, is Professor Limon McHenry. Professor McHenry is a bioethicist, emeritus professor of philosophy at California State University at Northridge, specializing in medical ethics and the philosophy of metaphysics. In the past, he has taught at the University of Edinburgh, where he received his doctorate at Old Dominion University, Davidson and Wittenberg University. And among his deep concerns are the corporate hijacking of modern medicine. He is not the first person to suggest that something has gone wrong. We have had at least 100 other people over the last 50 years, 55 years I've been broadcasting this program, 45 years on a daily basis on the non-commercial Pacifica stations. But there have been individuals throughout that time who've written about what has happened to our perspective when it comes to science. And today it is the worst that we've ever seen, and many people agree. Why? Because we're not allowing open, honest, and interesting debate where people come together, share their points of view, and then we see whether or not any of these points of view rise to the level of a positive hypothesis to be taken further and proven through both basic and applied sciences. Also confusing to the average person is their physician has led many of the patients to believe that what they are offering in the way of treatments or modalities or diagnosis is based upon evidence from the best of science. And indeed, many physicians, and historically I would imagine the majority, have used, when it was in existence, the library of medicines, a peer review system. But now we're seeing that even the peer review system, in many instances, has been corrupted. It was a Dr. Angell, who for 22 years was the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine and later professor at Harvard, who was one of the most important voices, but she was not alone. Today, Professor McHenry is carrying forward the idea that shouldn't we be able to trust science? What is wrong when we can't? By the way, for 15 years, my guest has been a consultant on medical ethics for the large law firm Baum, Hedlund, and Goldman, which work with Bobby Kennedy on winning the case against Monsanto. And Professor Limon has written several books on philosophy and is the co-author with psychiatry professor of the recent book, The Illusion of Evidence-Based Medicine, Exposing the Crisis of Credibility in Clinical Research. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary. I'm my privilege to be with you today, and I thank you very much and agree with almost everything that you said in your brilliant introduction.
I'm concerned that historically we have not had enough physicians and scientists and public health advocates, nurses as well, who've seen something was wrong, waited long enough to see that there were patterns of behavior, not just one-off examples which can occur anywhere under the most innocent and noble of efforts where something goes amiss and you say, wow, didn't anticipate that. But what I believe we are seeing, in part, especially from the more corporatized media and the more corporatized scientific community, which is dwarfed by the independent scientific community, but the independent scientific community is never brought in to adjudicate any of these controversies. To the contrary, the very people who are asked to adjudicate is something right or wrong, did we get it the right the first time, or must we recalibrate, are people who have a vested interest. And that concerns me. But when looking through your book, The Illusion of Evidence-Based Medicine, I'm reminded that when the evidence-based theory appeared in the early 1990s, and even several years was being praised as one of the late 20th century's greatest medical achievements that would revolutionize medicine, it was as though there was finally that aha moment. Here was an unbiased, observable, and measurable methodology, which is supposed to be the gold standard of science, that could properly evaluate medical protocols and practices and drugs, vaccines, etc., in order to reach a scientific consensus. And it would also help weed out those practices that were ineffective or even less safe. I think it gave some hope that medicine could finally evolve into a real science, because in the past there was good reason to consider medical practice in some as an art form and based upon subjective interpretations. In fact, this science versus art debate still persists in some corners, mainly among those who consider themselves the skeptics on Wikipedia. The Cochrane Collaboration, which emerged from the evidence-based theory, became a kind of flagship organization, the go-to resource for evaluating whether certain drugs, vaccines, or clinical interventions or medical devices should be prescribed or not. But then things went awry. Evidence-based medicine itself, in part, seems to have become just another tool for some corporate and pharmaceutical interest. So can you begin, please, by having us understand your concept of the original promises of evidence-based medicine and why it promised to set a gold standard in order to advocate for the best medical practice? And then following that, were there certain flaws in this entire paradigm at the start that nobody seemed to pay attention to that eventually contributed to its decline, and now, in some sections, it's being completely corrupted? Take your time. The form is yours.
Well, first of all, evidence-based medicine is an epistemological concept. It's a hierarchy of reliability of evidence. And as you said, the gold standard is the randomized placebo-controlled trials at the very top, at the apex of the triangle. And it was a brilliant idea that did, in fact, revolutionize medicine. And if you just go in the teaching hospitals today, you see it implemented in a very powerful way, in the sense that doctors regularly meet for what they call journal club to assess some of the latest randomized trials that have been produced and to have a discussion about treatments. Now, the evidence-based medicine concept is not without its flaws, just as a theoretical concept, but that's not my main concern. My main concern is that roughly 90% of the randomized placebo-controlled trials are being conducted by the pharmaceutical industry, and those trials are notoriously corrupted by the financial motivation. And that's what I've seen up close in the past 17 years working at a plaintiff's law firm, namely Baumhedlin, Aristi, and Goldman in Los Angeles. And I have teamed up with various experts, one of which is the psychiatrist John Girardini, with whom I wrote the book, The Illusion of Evidence-Based Medicine. We were given access to the secret documents, thousands and thousands of these documents from those clinical trials, and we were able to see up close just exactly how those trials are corrupted, how they're manipulated to favor the study medication against either the comparator drug or the placebo. So we argue that evidence-based medicine is an illusion. It is a great concept. Were it implemented in a way in which the scientific foundation of medicine could proceed with absolute trust and reliability? But that's simply not the case. So by and large, you know, what's happening when doctors go into journal club or they look at their practices evidence-based, that if they were to really see just exactly how these trials are being manipulated, they would realize that we're back to square one, so to speak, that the most reliable evidence that the physician has is his own prescribing experience and perhaps the prescribing experience of his colleagues. But this is just anecdotal evidence. This is not the scientific way to proceed. So what we have is a corruption of the system, and it's particularly alarming that the regulatory agencies and the government don't do anything about it.
When you talk about the manipulation of clinical trials and relaxed requirements for submitting trial data that is often tainted or false, we're looking at corporate reliance on public relations firms and ghostwriters and how that works. Big Pharma's takeover of university departments and medical school curriculum and medical journals and the journals' reliance upon the profits received from Big Pharma to publish their studies. And most importantly, the $5 billion, with a B, dollars that the pharmaceutical industry collectively spends on advertising to the media, in the media, and with the media each year. That does not include the hundreds of millions of dollars that is spent lobbying legislators at the state level through the American Legislative Exchange Council and at the federal level. And there are over 40,000 consultants, lobbyists, and experts all doing the same thing, the bidding of a particular corporate interest. You then also have a unique phenomena. You have a person who is, let's say, with a pharmaceutical company sitting on their board of directors to give them advice, who also is affiliated with a bank or a financial institution or has come from a government regulatory agency. Judy Gerberding, the former head of the CDC, is but one example. She was there to protect the public, to see that vaccines were made safely and with efficacy, and yet she was also one of the people who was aware that there was a flaw in their MMR vaccine. A Dr. William Thompson became a whistleblower, not voluntarily. Are you familiar with Dr. Thompson's case?
In what's called the revolving door phenomena, moving from regulatory agencies to the pharmaceutical industry, in particular at Merck,
where she received over $3.6 million in stock options and cashed them out. But what was important from my perspective, and I'd like you to look at the ethics of this, is that after the 40-year Tuskegee experiment, where hundreds of African Americans had syphilis and could have been treated and cured, they were left untreated to see how it would spread. Now, we know that syphilis and the spirochete is easily transmittable. And yet, imagine how many people, over 400 African Americans, were in touch with over a 40-year period, including those that were born, that would have been born with a syphilis they were not even aware of, congenital syphilis. And also, all anyone ever did was say, "We're sorry." The same CDC, around 2003, had an MMR vaccine program, and they were looking at the results, and lo and behold, they found a statistically significant increase in autism spectrum disorder in African-American young children, mainly males, 36 months and younger. It was a 324% increase. That startled, I mean, really shocked the doctor who was kind of overseeing this study, and he voiced his complaints, clear up the chain. Remember, it's a military organization in its structure. And everybody said, just keep quiet and do your work. But this was meaning that by his extension, that over 100,000 young African-American children would end up with autism spectrum disorder at the continuing rate of use within the community over the next 20 years. And he found that that was too great a burden to bear. So he began to speak with a person named Dr. Brian Hooker, professor in science at California University. In any case, in one of the conversations, he let this slip that they were told, put all your notes together and destroy them. And so everybody who was involved in this brought all their notes together and the results, and they destroyed them, except he kept one copy out of fear he would tell Brian Hooker. that if he was ever called before Congress or there was Freedom of Information Act request, he didn't want to end up getting in trouble. And then that information got out of William Thompson. The CDC still has him employed, but he's got a gag order. He can't talk. Congress did not protect him. To the contrary, when Representative Posey wanted to have a congressional hearings to say, hold on a second, Big Pharma, the makers of this MMR vaccine, are not allowing a congressional committee to under oath to investigate this. And to this day, 4 years later, not a single hearing has occurred because the people involved did not want to jeopardize their funding. So as a result, we've been led to believe that the MMR vaccine, unlike some vaccines which are necessary and safe, this one has a proven track record. But of all things to go at the CDC when you've already engaged in a systemic racist issue and you're doing it again, all for the profit and the bottom line. So Gerberding goes from protecting us supposedly and then going to work for Merck. And to me, that is just one of many examples. And the ethics of this, shouldn't we have an ethic that goes beyond just the law to actually show that a person is engaged in this activity?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, the issue that you're raising here is about transparency and about suppression of open critical discussion on the matter. I mean, I think that the causal relationship between the vaccine and autism is at present an extremely difficult one to establish, and it's one that should be explored in detail rather than pushed under the carpet. So I'm not quite familiar with that case enough to comment on it, but very, very broadly, I think I'm in agreement with you about how the pharmaceutical industry largely controls the process to their own advantage, and marketing, it usurps science in this case.
One of the things that allows you to stand out as not just a unique professor, because not every professor becomes an emeritus professor, that is one of the highest honors bestowed by an institution to show the contribution over a person's career in their field, and that is almost universally acknowledged by other outstanding academics around the world. And yet, if you were to go into a class and on a regular basis dispense misinformation that you know is misinformation, at some point you're going to break the bond of trust and probably find yourself either reprimanded or removed. And yet, many of the pharmaceutical companies are making drugs that where their reputation is that they have systematically lied, they have engaged in obfuscation, they have kept information that could have kept people alive if a drug up front was like Vioxx from Merck was said that it could cause an increase in heart attacks and strokes. Dr. David Graham of the FDA said that, and he was shut up for that. And yet, yes, in a four-year period, a minimum of 100,000 people, but I've seen the figure go up to as close as 500,000, died because of that. And there was no follow-up to see how many more people died from the strokes or heart attacks they had initially. The company denied any vulnerability. They only voluntarily took the product off the market. It was never demanded by the FDA. And as a result, they made billions of profit, even though they finally had to give the government about $5.3 billion to cover all most of their lawsuits. And yet the stock went up in value. Nobody went to jail. Nobody was ashamed. Nobody lost their position. What does that tell us when something that actually takes more lives than the entire Vietnam War of Americans, and yet the company gets a bonus in its stock value and everybody's happy?
Yeah, well, that tells you that there's something seriously wrong with the way in which government is colluding with the industry. And I think that your point is well taken about the personal responsibilities that professors must take in terms of how they go about conducting themselves and teaching their classes and doing their research and publishing the results of their work. And what we find is part of the corruption of medicine by the pharmaceutical industry is the co-opting of academics that they call key opinion leaders. The key opinion leaders are the ones that are out there having the most influence on prescribing physicians. And yet what is really going on is that they're nothing but names that are lending their professorial status and the status of their university to branding the pharmaceutical products. And this I find to be quite scandalous because, as you said, whenever there's and harms that are caused by these drugs, like in the case of Merck's Vioxx, nobody ends up being held accountable. And I think until we start to see these key opinion leaders at prestigious academic universities being held accountable for being nothing more than expensive sales reps for the pharmaceutical industry, or the marketing executives of these pharmaceutical companies being held accountable, not a whole lot is going to change. So the point is well taken.
Thank you. Let's go a little deeper on this topic. There's a Professor Peter Goetze. You're familiar with him from the Cochrane Group?
I certainly am, yes. He's a friend of mine.
Well, why don't you give us your insights as to what happened to him when he finally had both the courage and the temerity to say what he had been observing for a long time and calling out sections of the pharmaceutical industry, equating them no more ethical than organized crime, and the blowback against him. The punishment was swift and severe.
Well, indeed, that is a very unfortunate situation, but it's very common with almost all whistleblowers. And the problem with Dr. Peter Goetze is that he is not compromising a bit on this whole issue of the corruption of medicine. I think that he takes his moral responsibility as a doctor to be supreme, and he's not going to compromise that the least bit. He's seen up close what exactly the pharmaceutical industry is doing in corrupting medicine and how that is now spreading to the very sorts of institutions that are supposed to guarantee the reliability of evidence-based medicine, namely the Cochrane. So in the case of Dr. Goetze, what happened was he criticized a meta-analysis that was done by the Cochrane on the vaccine Gardasil. And that led to his eventually being expelled from the Cochrane and also losing his position as a professor at the university in Copenhagen.
It was brutal. Isn't it interesting that a person telling the truth alone in that spotlight received all that negative attention, and yet the very companies that were responsible for injuries and deaths receive a pass consistently? That said, would you give us your best guesstimate of what is behind the media? And I realize this is subjective. I realize this is merely hypothetical. But from day one of COVID, there's only been one opinion allowed. That was the official narrative by a group of individuals, and not the least of which was Bill Gates, who would later go on to purchase some interest or buy it out. Some of the Cochrane publications had some, there was some financial transaction. I thought, oh, there goes the Cochrane Group. But in this case, any doctor, any scientist, no matter what their background or credentials, who offered even a slight criticism was simply deplatformed. They were raced off all social media, and suddenly Wikipedia began to pay attention to them and attack them. And as you know, when someone attacks you on Wikipedia, it's like being put into an intellectual gulag. You're on the inside, and you can't change anything, even though their rules say you can. It's all not true. But now what we have is we have a group of individuals, one from Harvard, one from Stanford, one from Cambridge, who are Oxford, who are so concerned about certain aspects being wrong and the policies coming from that, that they create the Great Barrington Declaration. And now it has, I believe, over 55,000 signatories, mainly physicians and scientists. There's a lay one that has a lot more signatures. But these are mainstream, pro-vaccine, orthodox people, and rarely, if ever, do you hear them speaking out in this manner. But they are. And now there are over 100,000 scientists coming forward to say, hold on, we got this wrong. We rushed too fast into this, and why didn't we look at that? And why were you using the PCR test when you could have used an antibody test to be more accurate, et cetera, et cetera? There's a lot of loopholes and a lot of discrepancies, and yet not once has anyone in the mainstream media acknowledged that we may have a problem. Your thoughts, please.
Well, this violates one of the most fundamental norms of science, and that is open critical discussion, that all evidence should be examined very sort of carefully and sorted out, and we should not have any form of censorship. And that's what we're experiencing, though. And I'm not quite sure exactly what is going on, who's pulling all the strings here, but at least we're now starting to see some pushback. And you probably know that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has a lawsuit against Facebook for having censored him and a lot of other scientists who have proposed very sensible, reasonable views that just happened to run contrary to the orthodoxy.
I agree with that. Thank you. It was 10 years ago I began researching the concerns of farmers around the United States. These are small farmers, mainly organic farmers, and that there was a whole problem with their glyphosate coming onto their property. And then they were getting sued wind drift or bird droppings and the seeds. And these genetically engineered seeds, as well as the glyphosate spray, were then on their property, even in small amounts. And instead of removing it, they got sued for not having a license to use it. It was an absurd situation. But once I began to dig into this, I saw that there were farmers that had families and animals that were having health issues that were not normal for a farmer. And I'm a certified organic farmer. I teach organic farming principles, and sustainable agriculture is one of my hobbies. But in any case, we really went to work on this. And lo and behold, I did a documentary. It was called Seeds of Death. And immediately it was attacked. Now, mind you, I've done a lot of documentaries, and they're very accurate. They're always independently vetted for accuracy. And they were saying there's no such thing as a problem with glyphosate or genetically engineered seeds. And yet the scientific evidence showed just the opposite. And since I was back in a part of the Rachel Carson effort to bring the dangers of DDT, and she was our greatest environmentalist, and upon her shoulders all the rest of us stand, and she took the hits, just a marine biologist, this lone person, but she was speaking truth to power. She just didn't realize how powerful they were and what they would do to destroy her reputation in her own life. But in 1972, we finally got DDT banned. Then all this science came out showing it was bad. What did it mean? It was any less bad the day before we banned it? It was an insane notion. So then, everybody who said anything against Monsanto was attacked, and even some scientists working with inside. So now we know, after the lawsuits, that one lawsuit that started it. And I don't know if Kennedy was involved in the first, the second, or third lawsuit, but there were three lawsuits, and I'm not sure which ones you might have participated in. But when it was shown that, yes, these are dangerous, and then a Freedom of Information Act request found about 16,000 more or less documents from Monsanto that showed, and you look down, all the cancers that they knew it caused, I thought, well, this is going to end Monsanto's reign of disinformation on its product. It didn't happen. They've settled with Bayer, who bought the company, for billions of dollars, and now they expect to be profitable again. And yet glyphosate is still being sprayed as if it were a harmless, pesticide. And so that just showed me, but inside those lawsuits, it showed the dirty tricks, the groups of PR firms they were hiring to go after any critic. And by the way, the pharmaceutical company has been shown to do the same identical thing, hiring big PR firms and targeting anyone to try to destroy their reputations. And the media has not challenged any of this. Your thoughts, please.
Yes. Well, I did, in fact, participate in those three California trials. I was doing a lot of the document review, and I was also participating in the depositions of some of those key industry executives. So I've seen up close just exactly how science is also corrupted by the chemical industry, in this case, Monsanto. Ironically, Monsanto sort of presents itself as a science-based company and would frequently quote scientists such as Charles Darwin to sort of, as part of their PR, to get across to the public that they were a responsible, evidence-based company and responsible producer of, in this case, herbicides. And it turns out to be just exactly the opposite. This was all nothing but window dressing. So in any case, I think all of this traces back to the playbook that was originally written by the tobacco industry in the 1970s and the 1980s, when they were facing lawsuits, regulatory action, and the playbook that was developed by the tobacco industry to create decoy science, to co-opt academics into their agenda, trying to sort of reverse the direction that science was going, has been adopted by the pharmaceutical industries, and it's been adopted by chemical industries such as Monsanto. So I saw a lot of evidence of this in reviewing their internal documents and seeing just exactly how they were rigging the results of experiments, and they were attempting to intimidate and neutralize scientists around the world who were producing research that was showing that glyphosate or the compound Roundup was in fact carcinogenic and caused non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They were absolutely brutal in the way in which they handled criticism. And I actually became a victim of this myself because I published a paper called The Monsanto Papers, Poisoning the Scientific Well, in which I exposed how Monsanto had engaged ghostwriters to produce manuscripts published in toxicology journals that were nothing more than advertisements for their products and were suppressing all of the adverse events. And what happened to me in this case is that my manuscript went through peer review, five peer reviewers. It was accepted for publication in a research ethics journal. And then the publisher that owned that journal, Taylor and Francis in England, put a hold on my paper and refused to publish it. So I had to publish it in a journal in the Netherlands called the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine. So that just shows you how at various levels the corporations line up together and support each other. In this case, the publishing industry was attempting to suppress my research and try to have my the editors who accepted my paper reverse their decisions of a peer review on the basis of the fact that it would, publishing my paper would help the lawsuits that were going on in California.
That refers in some way back to what I mentioned, where you'll have a board of director member who sits on a pharmaceutical board but also may come from a government regulatory agency or then may sit on a FDA or CDC advisory panel and have a clear and present conflict of interest. How can you vote upon a drug that your company is making? That's right. Nonsensical. And yet that's exactly what has happened. I saw that with the case of Vioxx. No, excuse me. Not Vioxx. The case was a selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drug, the ones that contain Paxil and Luvoxx and Effexor. And the person, many people on there had some conflict of interest, yet they were not recused. They allowed to pass that through. And the public then thinks that anything the FDA says is safe and effective must be, because the FDA must do all this heavy-duty testing. When the FDA doesn't do any of its own testing, it relies upon the very companies that have a proclivity or an interest in fudging or changing. After all, if a company has 100 experiments on a drug and 99 turn out to be negative, but one turns out to be positive, guess which one they're going to give to the FDA? And that's what goes right in medical journals. This is unfortunate. A different question, though, is if we were to look at the entire medical establishment as it now operates today as an immense citadel, how would you describe it, and how would you describe its means of governance and medical control over the health of our lives? Because here we are speaking about something larger than simply generating profits and making pharmaceutical companies wealthier, although that is a powerful incentive. But it is also a scientific ideology. It is an ideology that Bertrand Russell and Ivan Illich, and I interviewed Ivan Illich, warned about. So how would you describe or define this medical kingdom that rules over us, especially in light of the fact that they have immediate access to all the government regulatory agencies, every one of them, every agency, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, Fauci's group, the National Cancer Institute, the FDA, National Institute on Aging, and all under the U.S. Public Health Service umbrella, and they also have access to the Surgeon General, and they are the ones always, always having their scientists go before committees to, in effect, paint the best picture on something instead of having independent scientists who give a more realistic and honest picture, and they control all of that, plus most of the media.
Well, I'm going to take a stab at that question. If I don't answer it properly, I want you to press me. In the book that Dr. Girardini and I published, in the final chapter, we look at solutions to the problem, and we really see this as a political problem. It's a systematic failure of government to address the corruption of medicine. It's a systematic failure of government to ensure the reliability of science and the integrity of science. And the reason why we have such a serious problem here is because our regulatory agencies are subject to political decisions, lobbying of the government by the largest lobby in the United States, which is the pharmaceutical industry. And that money buys legislation. It buys favorable legislation to them. You mentioned Marcia Angel, who was the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. She has pressed this point repeatedly, that when you get this favorable legislation, the FDA has to follow it. And in many cases, this is where we have the essence of the corruption. The lax standards for approving a drug. And what has essentially happened over the years is that we've gone from the idea that the regulator provides oversight of the industry to the idea that the regulator treats the industry as a client. And the client is paying a user fee to have their drugs or their vaccines approved. And they can even pay to have for a rapid approval. And this I see as one of the main sources of the problem. But you also mentioned the importance of independent scientists weighing in on the research that's being done, rather than having the key opinion leaders who have a vested interest because they're on the payroll of the pharmaceutical industry out there providing their biased opinion that is nothing more than repeating what the corrupted results have essentially produced. So what we argue is that we need independent testing of pharmaceuticals to take the clinical trials out of the hands of the pharmaceutical industry. This needs to be the responsibility of government and universities rather than the pharmaceutical industry testing their own products. If you think about it, the idea is absurd. It's the proverbial fox guarding the hen house.
I agree with that. Thank you. I appreciate that very lucid answer. Let's go a little deeper on this one, and please give us some examples from your own experience about the manipulation of clinical trials and the relaxed requirements for submitting that data that will frequently allow tainted, as you mentioned, Dr. Angel found that when she was the New England Journal of Medicine, or out-and-out false, corporate reliance upon public relation firms and, as you mentioned earlier, ghostwriters, and how that works. The big pharmas virtually can take over whole departments of universities and the medical schools and medical journals who rely upon profits from the big pharmaceutical companies. Could you take us through that whole scenario, please?
Yes. Well, there is a whole cottage industry that has grown out of pharmaceutical industry marketing, which basically comes from public relations firms that specialize in medical communications. And they are one of the main forces of the source of the manipulation of the data. They are the ones who ghostwrite all of the manuscripts that end up being published in the medical journals. They are the ones who engage the key opinion leaders to do the promotion to prescribing doctors and things like lunch and dinner talks and in conference presentations. And also they have taken over continuing medical education. Why? Because they show up with money. And it's very difficult to refuse that. But this is exactly what academic medical centers need to do to reverse this disastrous course that we're set on is by refusing pharmaceutical industry support. Now, the medical communications companies are engaged by the pharmaceutical industry to report the results of the clinical trials in the medical journals and in conference proceedings and in continuing medical education. And this eventually trickles into the clinical guidelines that doctors rely upon when they prescribe medications to their patients. And so I've even seen that line of corruption beginning with the pharmaceutical industry marketing department to the medical communications company, all the way down to the prescribing guidelines. So the information that comes out at the other end of this corrupt process, that's eventually gets to patients like you and me and to our doctors. One courageous editor of The Lancet, Richard Horton, called it an information laundering routine, that the medical journals have become nothing more than information laundering platforms for the pharmaceutical industry. And by that, I take it what he means is it's, you know, something like what mobsters do when they launder money. You've got dirty money that comes in and it comes out the other end as clean money. And in this case, what we've got is dirtied medical information namely the corrupted clinical trials reports that come out the other end looking clean, because these people are professionals. They know what they're doing. They can make the spun data look just exactly like the real science. There's the problem. And nobody has really done a whole lot to correct this, except one person. And interestingly enough, it was Senator Charles Grassley, who vigorously went after the pharmaceutical industry and went after these academics who were being paid billions and millions of dollars to put their names on these fraudulent manuscripts when he was on the Senate Finance Committee. Unfortunately, when he went off of that committee, they just went back to business as usual.
That's Washington. We've assumed that randomized double-blind placebo-controlled studies are the gold standard for determining a drug or vaccine's efficacy. What are the flaws in this, and how is this standard manipulated by some drug makers in order to arrive at a drug company's desired results to show the efficacy or safety of their product, even if it does not warrant it by the actual science?
Yeah, very good question. To get into the specifics here, there are all kinds of tricks that the pharmaceutical industry uses to design trials, to conduct trials, and to report trials to get the results that they want. So in many cases, it's in the design of the scientific test of the clinical trial where you can find the flaws. And these are very, very hard to detect, by the way, even by experts. So just to give you a couple examples, whenever you design a randomized placebo-controlled trial, you produce a protocol, and the protocol specifies just exactly what the endpoints are going to be for success in the trial, how the trial is going to be conducted, how patients are going to be excluded, what constitutes a trial violation, things of this sort. And in looking at the protocol and comparing it with the final study report that's produced by the pharmaceutical industry, which will be sometimes as much as 2,000 or 3,000 pages, you very often find just exactly how things have gone terribly wrong. Just to give you a couple of examples here. Suppose you start off with certain endpoints, what are going to call primary and secondary endpoints for what's going to count as the drug establishing efficacy against placebo. Now, as you conduct the trial and they break the blind and they see the results and they don't get the results that they want. So what do? They can slice and dice the data in various ways. They can start to modify these primary and secondary outcomes. They can report some, not report others in such a way that they get what they want in terms of efficacy. And so this has been described with an analogy that I find very illuminating. Suppose that you are throwing darts against a door, and then you go up to the door and you draw the target afterwards to say, oh, there you go. See, I got a bullseye. Well, this is what they're doing with regard to how they manipulate the efficacy. Now, the same thing goes for safety, because in a clinical trial, you're interested both in the performance of the drug in terms of its outperforming placebo, and you're also interested in what kind of adverse events result from an examination of the drug versus the placebo. Now, suppose, for example, you're testing an SSRI antidepressant, and you start to see some disturbing signals about suicidality in this trial. Well, how are you going to report that? That's the trick. Now, in the case of GlaxoSmithKline, in a famous study, 329, they decided to report this as something called emotional lability. And nobody knew what emotional lability was, basically. It's everything from crying to a suicide attempt. And this is how they hid the suicidality in a clinical trial for adolescents.
Wow, that's terrible. You're sacrificing children's lives. And this is not the first time that this has happened. Just as an aside note, I recall reading a paper of Harvard and Massachusetts General Hospital that argued that even in these randomized controlled trials, participants who had received the drug and showed improvement may actually have done so due to the placebo effect, in the same way that someone who takes the placebo shows improvement. I recall this paper was primarily focused on psychiatric drugs. If this is true, then technically the results of every randomized study ever performed on a drug that was FDA approved is potentially, or at least theoretically, flawed. And based upon all my research and medical science and neuroscience does not understand the mind-body mechanisms behind the placebo effect, they simply don't understand it. And how could they? Neuroscience is still clueless about the origins and actual causes of the mind and consciousness. They believe it's all due to the brain and neural activity, but there's not a single study that can prove this. Brain-mind correlations, yes. There is plenty of excellent research proving there are correlations between brain activity and our mentations, but there is no study that I could find to prove that the brain is the actual cause of thoughts, feelings, and images, and memories, etc., or that all of our mental and emotional experiences are caused solely by the brain. And yet, ironically, this gold standard we are speaking about to conduct clinical trials relies on testing a drug or vaccine against a placebo that the researchers don't understand. Your thoughts, please.
Yes, well, psychiatry is particularly vulnerable to the corruption, and it's because the clinical trials are based upon these surveys that are very subjective in nature. And so they're easily manipulated by the pharmaceutical industry. But I think that in the case of antidepressant use in children and adolescents, what we're faced with today is one of the biggest scandals in medicine, where the evidence base is completely opposite of what has been promoted by the marketing. And I think that this also holds to various degrees in how these drugs have been promoted using disease-mongering campaigns to adults.
I would certainly agree with that. That's a very important, insightful point. We're coming up near the end of the program, and I'd just like to finish off with one thought, and that is, and then you would respond, of course. Right now, we're repeatedly hearing the mantra from government leaders, health officials, and across the media to follow the science. We are being told that scientists are the final authority, and experts on whatever science they embrace is the final word. In other words, to follow the science has become no different than following, in some instances, the laws of a church or religion or even a cult. In our ever-secularized society, medical science has become, well, it's become anointed. In effect, it's become sacralized by those who are most likely to benefit from the so-called science. We're witnessing this in the policies to mandate lockdowns, masks, etc., or which drugs are permitted and which are not permitted to treat different diseases. And so I'm concerned deeply about this, that we're veering too far off path. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, I wish it were as simple as putting trust in the science and following the science, but it's not so easy. The science can very often be contradictory, and the experts working with it at the very top levels often find it very confusing trying to sort it out. But what makes the problem so much worse is the commercial motive that the pharmaceutical industry has, and how they have basically muddied the waters by disinforming us with all of their marketing dressed up to look exactly like the science.
You're absolutely right. I really appreciate this discussion. I'm sorry it's over. We only had an hour. But thank you very much for being with us today, and all the best on your new book. And by the way, my guest's new book is called The Illusion of Evidence-Based Medicine. From California, Professor Limon McHenry. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you to cry.